And you're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Max Newman.
And I'm Arman Rana.
And I'm Christina Song. It's Thursday, May 23rd at 5.02 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, we speak with George Benson, an urban planner and consultant who currently works with the Vancouver Economic Commission and a variety of other organizations to tackle climate policy.
During our phone interview recorded last Friday, George gave us his view of the six big moves and the economic benefits of the recently passed six big moves in response to the climate emergency.
We're also going to hear an interview I did with Larry Beasley, a former director of planning for the City of Vancouver and the current professor of urban planning here at UBC. In my interview, Beasley talks about his new urban planning book, Vancouverism, which launches tonight. He's received some criticism for this book based on his close connections with developers and because of the lack of affordability in Vancouver right now. During his time working as the director of planning for the City of Vancouver, he had developed certain principles, and he is going to share those during the interview.
Cool, very interesting. So we're going to start out with our interview with George Benson, which Max and Arman, who are in studio with me now, mentioned at the just a couple of minutes ago at the top of the show. So before we go to that interview, I just wanted to ask, because with the City of Vancouver recently passing its plans to deal with the climate emergency we're currently in, which included the six big moves that Arman mentioned. So things like making it so that people are closer, living closer to where they work, using more public transit, using more biking and walking and physical means of getting around, and other things in order to reduce our carbon emissions and keep them below the 1.5% increase that was set by the Paris Climate Accord for being, you know, what we need to cap our climate emission increase at in order to keep life going here on Earth. So, Arman, you were the one who suggested interviewing George Benson. And I just wanted to ask you why you wanted to interview him, even though, you know, this subject of the city's six big moves has been covered quite thoroughly in the media. Why did you feel it was important to get his perspective in there as well?
Well, two things. I think firstly, a lot of the coverage or the way it's framed is like it's an existential kind of threat, which it is. And this tiny little city of Vancouver is coming up against climate change. But yeah. I think what that misses is there's some very direct, small but significant economic benefits to the city of Vancouver as well. And I think George brings that up a lot in our discussion. And also, we speak a lot to young people who are outside the system, who are activists, who are trying to change the system.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe we speak to some older people who are policy experts. I found it interesting to speak to George because he kind of bridges both those worlds as a somewhat younger person who's also working in climate policy.
Right, yeah, he's a millennial, right?
Yeah. I think he's roughly our age, maybe a couple of years older than us.
Yeah. Wait, how old is he? He's older than you guys, right?
Like probably 4 or 5 years older than
yeah,
me.
Yeah, like his late 20s or something, right?
Yeah,
that's a really good point. And like you said, he brings an economic perspective, which talks about how our economy will change and potentially benefit from changes that we make.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to mitigate climate change. Cool. Well, let's go to that interview now, and we'll talk maybe a bit more about it after. Here we go. So this is George Benson.
Hi, George. It's Arman from CITR. All right, yourself. So I'm here with Max, and we're going to get set up for the interview.
Okay. Joining us on the phone is George Benson, an urban planner and consultant who currently works with the Vancouver Economic Commission and a variety of others on climate policy. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Can you start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for having me again. So yeah, my name is George Benson, and I am planner and consultant. I've worked in climate policy for the past 5 years now with different city governments, with the Economic Commission and nonprofits, doing a variety of work related to policy development as well as managing some programs. I do a lot of research as well, and I am also involved a lot in the sort of nonprofit volunteer community doing, again, a lot of climate-related work.
Mm-hmm. So one of the questions we've been grappling with is how our city will change in response to climate change and as a consequence of climate change. From an economic perspective, how do you perceive the city changing? What are some of the ways you perceive it changing in the next few years?
Oh, that's the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? When we look at, for example, if we talk about the city of Vancouver, we are positioned in many ways to be a city that succeeds and in certain cases benefits from climate change. We have a really vibrant green economy here. We have many people that work in the green building sector that are developing clean tech, that are trying to develop either policies or solutions or programs that can be adapted and scaled around the world. We have a lot economically to gain from climate change in a way that other communities don't. But that said, we still face, of course, all of the negative impacts of climate change that will be facing our community, as well as some of the kind of transition challenges that any community faces as part of moving to live in a more sustainable way. Just on the sort of immediate physical challenges of climate change first, we know and kind of have the lived experience now that Vancouver is in a forest fire area, right? We are going to continue to experience the negative impact of forest fires and flooding from now into the future. There's lots of things I think that the provincial government and many other actors are going to be doing to try and mitigate the impact of forest fires and flooding. But at the end of the day, we are surrounded by a variety of natural features. We have mountains and hills and forests and rivers and oceans that are all going to impact us. You know, just quick data point, in 2016, due to the wildfires and floods, there are about 60,000 people that were displaced in British Columbia because of climate change. We still don't know how many of those folks have fully returned yet. We would suspect most of them are probably back in their communities, but particularly vulnerable communities and persons there, the likelihood of them being back to where they would like to be is lower in some cases. And when we think about sort of a longer term horizon, you know, we're looking at the immediate future. Floods and forest fires will continue to challenge us, but extreme heat will be another feature. We saw, I think it was 90 people in Quebec died last year due to extreme heat waves. And depending on what kind of climate projections you're looking at, we expect Vancouver to have the sort of low temperate climate or subtropical climate of a place like San Diego, let's say, by the latter half of the century.
That's hard to imagine. Again,
yeah. It is quite hard to imagine, isn't it? You know, we think of like Sunset Boulevard and places in LA and everything, palm trees. This is the temperate rainforest that we're used to. So those are big changes that we have coming down the pipe, and those will produce kind of immense costs and challenges for us. On the kind of transition risk side, we haven't talked about in climate policy that you've got your immediate physical risks of climate change, then you have the transition risk. Canada is still a country that relies tremendously on fossil fuels for economic growth, as well as for kind of meeting its daily needs. Vancouver is uniquely situated, again, in Canada, having, if not easily one of the lowest carbon footprints per capita in the country. Usually it's around 3.8 or 3.9 tons per person, and the other cities that kind of come close to that are usually in Quebec, like Montreal and others. We, again, are well positioned to adapt and change our economy, but there are going to be costs and there are going to be significant changes. So getting into the weeds there, we're talking about the decarbonization of our building stock. That means no more gas furnaces in the longer term. That means moving away from fossil fuel vehicles. And if you're looking at the work that's been done in the climate emergency resolution, that means some significant physical changes to our landscape. That means much, much more connectivity. So getting people walking and biking and cycling to the places that they need. It means a change in the urban form so that the things that you need are closer to you, like grocery stores, libraries, clinics, your job. Those are all ideally going to be built much closer to you because we won't have the carbon budget to have everybody driving and running around everywhere. And we certainly won't be able to, we won't want people to be moving into places that may be dangerous but more affordable, like flood zones or areas with risk of forest fire. We're going to try and situate more folks in existing urban centers. So, you know, if you kind of stack all those things together, it means that we have a bigger city that has some very different economic practices than it has now. And it's a city that is going to be moving and working in different ways, whether it's just walking and cycling more or consuming different kinds of things, consuming less in the case of fossil fuels and others. It'll be quite different.
I'm glad you brought up the six big moves and the actions the city is taking. We wanted to talk a little bit more about that. Before, let's just remind our listeners what the six big moves was about. The city of Vancouver recently adopted these moves to deal with climate change. They covered making Vancouver a walkable city, promoting active transport and transit, zero emission vehicles, zero emission heat pumps, and minimizing the embodied carbon in construction, as well as forest and coastal ecosystem restoration. And a lot of these have targets, specific targets for either 2025 or 2030. What were some of the aspects of the six big moves that impressed you in some way or surprised you that they included it? And what were some that you felt were lacking in some way?
I think the one that was probably most exciting and sort of most natural was the active transportation and transit. So much of our emissions in Vancouver come from our transportation sector. If you look at the Renewable City Strategy that was passed in 2016, we said that as a city, we want to become 100% renewable. We want all the energy we use, whether that's in our buildings, our electricity systems, our transportation system, we want all those to be renewable. And when you look at the total energy that's used in Vancouver, the vast majority of that is still not renewable is in our transportation sector. So if you look at big move number two, active transportation and transit, they're not only saying that city wants to see people moving into electric vehicles, but they want people to drive less. Two-thirds of trips will be made in Vancouver through active transportation. So that's walking, rolling, biking, and on mass transit. That's a kind of slam dunk easy win. We know that, I shouldn't say easy win, it's something that is a well-established goal. Yeah. We know and are familiar with that.
Well, we just passed 50%, right? Like 50% of those trips, yeah. That's amazing.
Which is a utterly astounding number in the North American context. There are very, very few other cities, and you know, we think of ones like New York, for example, that can claim that kind of number. And actually, it's worth noting that we hit that ahead of schedule. So Vancouver actually reached its goal ahead of schedule to get over 50% of trips through walking, biking, and transit. Now we have to go up from that, right? Two-thirds is a big number, and we only have 12 years to do it. Yeah. So that's a lot. But I think the most kind of, to your question more directly, the one that was most surprising, I think, was the walkable city. 90% of people will live with an easy walk or roll of their daily needs. That's an astounding number.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of lay terms, that means densifying our city. That means distributing our services, our businesses, the basic social functions and places that we gather. That means distributing them in a very equitable way, when, of course, right now they're not. We have about 75% of the land in the city is devoted to single-family zoning. And that means that if you want to live close to the things that you need, well, you're probably going to have to pay a lot more because there aren't as many places where a lot, like everything you need is in one place. Mm-hmm. So big move one to me is quite astounding in that sense. It's bold, it's provocative. It will probably make a lot of people really angry. But I think that when we talk about a climate emergency, we need to be making big moves, bold moves, right? And so that one was very exciting. The last one I'll throw out there is the embodied carbon is quite fascinating. Vancouver's been working on this for a while, and there's a lot of sort of policy and practice that's been developing here. We're definitely global leaders in this front. There are very, very few, almost no other places in the world that are thinking about this as deeply and as sophisticatedly as Vancouver is. However, getting to reducing the embodied carbon by 40% is going to be a Herculean task.
Yeah.
It will be a wonder, a marvel of engineering and analysis to figure out even just how we get there. And then to do it in practice will be very tough. That's not to say we can't do it, but it is going to be a challenging one. And I think from the economic perspective, that's where a ton of opportunities for innovation come from.
Can you just remind our listeners what embodied carbon is, and what can you give an example of it?
Yeah. So embodied carbon refers to all of the various fossil fuels that have been burned in the creation of a product, all the way back from like when the first digger dug its scoop into the mountain and pulled out some minerals to build whatever the whatever your, you know, say a girder or something was, the emissions from that that digging system to the emissions to the processing of the whatever the material is, the transportation, the installation, all of those different elements, all of those different emissions are combined into a number that is your embodied carbon. And that's important because when we think about where our emissions come from, a city like Vancouver has relatively low what we call stationary emissions. The things like, you know, you burn natural gas in your building. Okay, there's some emissions there. But if you think about like all the steel girders and the glass that are in our buildings, they're all emissions that came from somewhere else that maybe we're not counting. And so that means that we may be undercounting, and in some cases dramatically so, the amount of emissions that we actually produce. So lowering those emissions is really critical.
All right. Yeah, let's go to the next question. You hear a lot of people saying that the green regulations could somehow stifle economic growth in the city. What do you have to say to such concerns?
Well, I mean, having done a good deal of work with the Vancouver Economic Commission, which is the city's economic development agency, and having worked in other contexts where I've had the chance to look at the economics of climate change and these impacts, the answer is that no, these policies actually generate an incredible amount of economic opportunity. And what's more is that we have to look at the whole picture, right? It's not enough to say, well, a new building policy will generate X number of jobs or it'll lose us X number of jobs. We have to look at the broader context. So the Stern Review on Climate Change, for example, old report from 2006, it basically said, and it was the first report to really do this in a grounded way, it says that if we didn't act on climate change, we were going to lose about 5% of global GDP every year for now and forever. 5% of global GDP. Okay. And so we have to include the counterpoint. We have to include the case that didn't occur when we look at these calculations. It's not enough to say a building regulation will generate some jobs. It's also about, well, what did we prevent, right? And I think that when the good news is that when we look at a lot of these regulations, they generate economic benefits. They help us raise the wages of people that are working in sectors. They help us create new businesses. They help us generate new economic systems in some cases that are better, healthier, more regenerative, more just. Those are all good things. But they also stop us from hurting ourselves. And I think both of those things have to be taken together. And I'll just give you one data point really quickly on this. So the VEC completed a report this year which said that in with regards to some green building regulations in the city, there's a $3.3 billion market for new manufactured products in the green building sector between now and 2032. Just in Metro Vancouver, just in six product categories, if we look at the whole province and if we look at other factors, that number would be even bigger. But just in Vancouver, $3.3 billion. So that tells us that these regulations are doing a lot of good. That doesn't mean that every regulation is going to always generate economic benefit. But again, if we have that holistic picture, we can see where things are, what the sort of net result of them is. And in most cases, it's going to be really positive.
Yeah, we were just talking about the six big moves. But back in 2011, the city also laid out an ambitious plan, which was called the Vancouver's Greenest City Action Plan, which included double the number of green jobs and double the number of companies greening their operations. The goal was for Vancouver to become the greenest city by 2020, so next year. How close do you feel we are reaching these goals? And what lessons do you think we have learned or could learn from this experience when implementing the six big moves?
I think one of the most interesting impacts of the Greenest City Action Plan was that it created a sense of collective identity around being greener. You know, Vancouver always had a kind of loose but powerful set of identities around, we're really sustainable. David Suzuki's from here. Greenpeace was founded here, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the Greenest City Action Plan really sort of crystallized for people, one, that Vancouver was a leader and could kind of show the world how some of this was done. And two, that there were actually like really direct, tangible areas of action that needed to be taken. So, I'm a millennial. I grew up in the age of recycling and that everyone had to, save your water bottles or don't buy plastic water bottles. Make sure you put your cans away and make sure you separate out your paper and your garbage. That's not enough in 2019. It's critical that we do those things, but it's just scratching the surface of the whole range of things we need to do. So when you look at the Greenest City Action Plan, 10 goal areas across basically everything that the city can and could do, it really spelled out for people that we needed to be taking action on climate change, on some very specific policies. We needed to be doing work on green buildings, on transportation, on access to nature, clean water, local food, the green economy. And I think kind of critically, they also included something called a lighter footprint, which was a very holistic way of saying people in North America consume a great deal of resources. And we are not always conscious of all of the various, talk about embodied carbon. We're not always conscious of all the various ways that things, all the various components that it takes to make something and the different resources that go into it. That lighter footprint goal said, well, we need to reduce the environmental footprint of everything that we do. And again, I think that created an identity for us. So that's a really phenomenal thing that it did that. Are we going to become the greenest city in the world through that alone? No. I think the reason that we have a climate emergency resolution is that we haven't gotten far enough yet. But I think that, if anything, the Greenest City Action Plan has given us a platform to go forward. And now, if anything, it's helped us kind of understand just how much work we have to do. And now the really hard stuff starts to come forward.
One of the other themes that came up in a discussion about the recent property tax shift, for those who haven't heard, there was a 2% tax shift from residential to commercial properties in Vancouver to support small businesses. Mm. Is that supporting small businesses is somehow connected to making a more sustainable city? How do you see this connection?
Well, I think speaking as someone who's, you know, thought about, like, been in the environmental world pretty much my entire life and seen, I think there's a kind of natural antagonism that has emerged between, I shouldn't say natural, there has been a long-standing antagonism between businesses and environmental goals. And I think what I have always loved about the green economy goal in the Greener City Action Plan and the work that the VC and many others have done to help green our businesses is that it shows that there's a lot of diversity in the business sector. And there are a number of great young entrepreneurs like Not a Zero Waste Grocery, for example, or Portable Electric, Bullfrog Power. You know, there's so many in Vancouver we can name. Those businesses really see their purpose as driving positive environmental change. That's critical. That's really, really critical. I can't get into the specifics of the property tax shift. I think if you look at the numbers there, there's a strong argument to be made that our businesses pay much, 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 much higher taxes relative to residential rates. But I couldn't say to what degree those ratios are imbalanced or what the ideal number is. But suffice to say that businesses have really struggled. There was a report recently that 50% of industrial businesses in Vancouver are considering moving in the next 3 to 5 years because they're facing a whole number of challenges, but property taxes are one of them. If we have a strong business sector that can provide some of the solutions around climate change, and we have a chorus of businesses that say, you know what, I don't just care about doing the bare minimum on climate change. I actually think my entire business model and indeed, you know, our success as a city, as a civilization, depends on whether or not we take strong climate action. Those are the kinds of folks that I want to be, you know, standing arm in arm with as we go forward and start doing this really hard work that we're about to take on. That's, I think, the value of continuing to bring the business sector in. And there are people that generate really fascinating ideas and help move the needle in really powerful ways. One of my favorite businesses in the city is a group called Climate Smart. They go through and they help individual businesses certify and understand what their emissions are, how many GHGs they're producing, what the pathway for them getting to a lower amount would be, what it would take to make their targets scientific. You know, those are the kinds of moves that mean that climate action isn't just something that a big government does, right? It's something that individual organizations can take hold of. And if we're really going to solve climate change, it has to be something that is something that we're doing at every level. You know, individuals have to take action, businesses have to take action, faith groups have to take action, the province has to take action, federal government, et cetera. It has to be everybody all doing things at the same time, moving in the same direction. But if we're missing some sectors of society, like the business community, we're not going to make it.
Talking about climate action, just 2 weeks ago, I attended the latest Vancouver Youth Climate Strike. Mm-hmm. Where I've talked to Rebecca Hamilton. You may have heard of her. She's the organizer with Climate Strike Canada. And she got inspired by the Swedish climate youth activist Greta Thunberg and started to organize similar strikes since last December in Vancouver. And the students are demanding science-based targets to keep the temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on the young students who are demanding action on the climate crisis?
It's almost hard to put into words how inspiring the work that these people have done. You know, these are kids that are still trying to finish high school, that have a million things going on, that are in a period of great transition in their lives. And they're out on the streets protesting, and they're talking to leaders, and they're speaking truth to power. They're demanding that their future is taken care of, and they're not just used as political props by established leaders to say, oh, yeah, we're doing this in the interest of our children. They're saying, well, show me the numbers, you know, show me a climate plan that gets us to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Show me that you can do that. Show me that you care enough to do that. That's powerful stuff. And I think my heart is just continuously filled with hope when I see those kids speaking.
Yeah, is there any advice you would give them if you could?
Oh, my gosh. I feel like they should be giving me advice. I don't know so much advice, but a request. I mean, keep doing what you're doing. These things are clearly having an impact. You know, I'm hearing from different municipal folks across Metro Vancouver that they're starting to see climate change in a little bit of a different way. Now, some folks might not decide tomorrow that they're going to, you know, go for the kind of radical transitions we might need. But people's minds are being shifted by this, and they recognize that kids are really on the front lines of this in so many ways. You know, the Lancet, which is a global healthcare health study that is produced by the UK, and there's always these briefings on the impact of climate change through that. There was a really powerful headline that they had in their latest report in 2018 for Canadian policymakers, and they talked about the mental health impacts of climate change. it talked about how young people, indigenous communities, people on the front lines respond. So many people are already feeling the mental burden of climate change, and that policymakers need to have a response, because as climate change's impacts become greater and more visible, those feelings of grief or loss or hopelessness, they're only going to grow. And we need to have a mental framework, not just building berms and planting trees and, you know, building solar panels. We need to also have a mental and social framework for how we deal with the impacts of climate change. So I think that these kids are showing showing established leaders and adults that these mental impacts are really critical and in some cases debilitating. I think Greta Thunberg talks about being really depressed when she started to understand just how cataclysmic climate change was. Young people are feeling that everywhere, all around the world. I'm a bit older than these folks, but I can tell you right now that there are days when it's really hard to get up and go to work and say, gosh, you know, what are we doing? You know, are we really going to like do what we need to do? So I think folks understanding the emotional impact of climate change is critical, and these kids are helping do that.
On that last point, how as a person in your 20s, I believe, as a young person to some degree on a human level, how does it feel to be working on climate policy, an issue that appears to be so closely tied to the future of your and our generation?
It's hard. I think I would be lying if I said it wasn't hard, and not because I am particularly disadvantaged by climate change. In fact, I'm probably one of the more privileged people in the world when it comes to, you know, living in a country like Canada. I'm a white settler living in Canada. There's an immense amount of privilege that comes from the place that I occupy. But even still, with that said, you know, the work that I do, it is draining to know that every day emissions are still inching up and we still haven't made the kind of binding, long-term strategic moves that we need to. That's tough. I gave a talk recently where I was describing that feeling in terms of grief, that there's a sense of kind of impending loss that comes from working in climate change and understanding just how deeply it's going to impact myself and others in our community. Knowing that we're going to lose some things, whether that's landscapes that we're very used to, or some people's homes will be destroyed because they'll be underwater or the permafrost will melt or what have you. I think there's a deep and tremendous sadness that I feel knowing those things. But I think also that we live in an age now where we're trying, and I think, again, young people are leading this movement, we're trying to be more open about that sadness. There's been a lot of talk about how climate action needs to always be positive, and we need to always tell people that we're going to get there, don't worry, you know, 100% renewable is going to happen tomorrow. And I think that is possible. A better world is possible, and we're working our damnedest to get there. But it's disingenuous to say that there are also not costs associated with that, and that there will be challenges along the way. So I think being honest about those challenges and expressing some of that grief as a way of coping is really critical. And when we grieve, I think we also are able to then draw on, you know, all these different cultural and religious traditions about how we face hardship. And from those, we can keep getting up and moving forward. And I think the most important thing to recognize is that when we grieve for something, it means that it's important, right? It means that it was foundational to us in some way, and that can give us the strength to keep going.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today, George. We learned a lot, and I'm sure, you know, it's given us a better grounding in terms of the economic and the social aspects of what's going to come in the next few years in climate policy.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you both so much. It was such a pleasure to be speaking with you both. And if there's anything else I can help with, please let me know.
All right. Thanks for listening. This is CITR. You're listening to Democracy Watch. You just heard an interview with George Benson, who is a consultant with the Vancouver Economic Commission. He was talking about Vancouver's tactics to deal with climate change. The city's recently voted on 6 big moves, and the economic benefits that actually stand to be had. And that interview was done by Armand Reyna and Max Newman, with editing by Max Newman. So great work, guys. We'll be back with more local news coverage and more news from urban planners. We have Larry Beasley up next, the author of Vancouverism, and we're going to be hearing him respond to some criticisms on this new book and just hear about it, what Vancouverism is. So we're going to go to a short break, and then we'll be right back. Please keep listening.
able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Who we view as the most authoritative and electable is rooted in systems of oppression.
There are so many inequities around having our experts in our community speak about our work.
Obviously, there are several facets to this strangely homogenous nature of the electoral system.
And to be left out of conversations, it only exemplifies that loss of self-esteem.
Check out CITR's live panel podcast, Conversations, hosted by our Indigenous, Accessibility, and Gender Empowerment collectives. Subscribe to Conversations, available now on iTunes.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. If you're just tuning in, we started out with an interview with George Benson, a consultant with the Vancouver Economic Commission. He gave us his perspective on the six big moves and how beneficial they are to the city's economy.
So we're now going to move on to an interview I did with Larry Beasley yesterday. He spoke to us about a book that he's releasing today called Vancouverism, and it is all about the principles of urban planning that was applied when he was in office as the chief planner at the city of Vancouver. And he's responding to some criticism that the book has had. Let's take a listen.
Let's take a listen, and then we'll maybe talk about it a bit as well. Here we go. Larry Beasley.
So, can you start out by telling me who you are?
My name is Larry Beasley. I'm the author of a new book that's out called Vancouverism. I am a professor here at the university in the School of Community and Regional Planning, but I'm also a consultant working around the world, and I used to be, for many years, the co-chief planner of Vancouver.
Thank you. And can you explain what urban planning is?
Well, urban planning is how you organize and arrange the city and the people in the city in order that everyone can achieve their goals and you can create a quality living experience. And increasingly, you can also create a place that's consistent with its natural setting.
Okay, so you've mentioned this, but it's been a little over 10 years since you've been the chief planner for the city of Vancouver. Why have you decided to write this book now?
Mostly because I had time. For many years, as soon as I left the city in 2006, I was off around the world working. I founded the planning agency in Abu Dhabi. I designed a new national capital there. But it seemed to me that it was time that the story of that period from the Expo 86 to the Olympic Games, when this city made a dramatic transformation, that it was time someone told that story. And during that period, when I was very busy, no one did tell that story. So I said a couple years ago, well, you know, I'm going to make time now, and I'm going to sit down and write it out.
And that brings me to my next question. What was the state of urban planning in North America when you first started out?
Well, when I started out as a young person, which was about 45 years ago or so, planning was, it might be better to tell you what the state of cities were, because that would tell you what the state of planning was. The state of cities was that people were suburbanizing, core cities were dead, the core neighborhoods of cities, which we now enjoy so much, were losing population, they were falling down, there was all kinds of difficulties. And in my generation, we in a sense recreated the planning profession to try to respond to those issues that were really facing all North American cities and Canadian cities in particular. And so some of us took on the job of revitalizing community. Some of us took on the jobs of trying to deliver housing for low-income people. Some of us took on the jobs of how to bring to life our core cities that were so dead and so in trouble. The situation in Vancouver, moving now into the 80s, was even worse than many other cities, because our traditional economy, our resource-based economy, basically was globalized, and no longer were we necessarily an important place in that global economy. And it meant that a lot of jobs, good-paying jobs and good careers that people had taken for granted, were no longer available. And we had to think about what the city needs to be in the future in order to build a new economy, in order to position the city in the world as the whole world was coming together at that time. And that led to what happened in Vancouver, and particularly was the transformation of our inner city.
So I think we're getting to the title of your book, which is Vancouverism. Could you explain that more in detail?
Well, the word Vancouverism, no one really knows who coined the word. I certainly did not coin the word. There's various theories about that. But what happened was that starting in the late 70s and moving, getting very strongly underway in the late 80s through the 90s and through the turn of the century, Vancouver, because it had to reinvent itself, started all kinds of policies and actions and initiatives to make that reinvention happen. It happened that we did it by looking at the city in a different way than people were looking at cities in those days. We thought about the physical design of the city. We had lived in a world where people hadn't really been designing cities for almost 100 years, at least since the 1930s. We thought about design. We thought about public involvement. We thought about social responsibility. And then increasingly, as we got into the 90s, we started thinking about environmental responsibility, with the Brundtland Report coming out and other acknowledgments that coming out to all of our culture that we had to be more sensitive about the environment. And so because we did it so differently in Vancouver, we got a result that was different. We intensified, we diversified, we provided a framework of social responsibility and ultimately environmental responsibility that showed us in contrast to many other cities of the time. And people started saying, well, that's a different way of planning a city. And inevitably in the popular culture, someone put an ism on the end of that. I never like isms, to be honest. And I don't think Vancouverism is a different kind of practice of planning. But very early on, we had a philosophy which was very in contrast to the world around it. And interestingly enough, as we've moved into the decades since then, many of the things that we pioneered have now become standard in the world of urbanism and in the world of designing and building cities. But, you know, as I started then in 2006 and 7 traveling around the world working after I left my position in Vancouver, people all over the world were saying, wow, what did you do in Vancouver? How did you do it? That was very unique. That was very special. That's how an ism comes together, when something is in contrast to things around it. So for my book, it was frankly just a convenience.
Right.
It was just a use of a term that would have you ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
But it then opens up a discussion about a very, very different way of building cities.
I find that very interesting. Like a lot of the goals that you've stated, which is like sustainability, and in the book you say neighborhood is a priority and that's something that you should foster. But I'm wondering how that makes it particular to Vancouver itself.
Well, what was happening back in those days was that people were saying things like this. They were saying, well, with the new technologies, local association no longer matters, that people are going to know one another all over the world. People were saying that now that we all have cars, we don't really need to worry about walkability or anything like that. If you saw cities in the mid-20th century, things were being lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a whole zoning in the early and mid part of the 20th century that said everything should be separated out from everything else. And if you came into the 60s and 70s, you won't know this, you're too young. But everyone believed the car would solve everyone's problem. And it didn't matter anymore if you lived close or not close. Well, it turns out that was wrong.
Mm-hmm. So for you, is neighborhood more about having a very mixed use of a city space, or is it more about people like conversing with one another in a more regular basis?
Well, in my book, I try to describe the various components, and it's not a unidimensional kind of idea. On the one hand, it is a physical idea. It is to say that you want a neighborhood, you want a center of a community and facilities and services, commercial and public, civic services, within a 5 to 7 to 10 minute walk for a lot of people. That is a physical concept. But also, as we applied Vancouverism, we said we really also want social mix. We don't want all the rich to live in one place and all the poor to live in some other place. We were seeing all around North America ghettos of poor people, and those were being disinvested, and no one was really paying attention, and problems were happening. You saw the riots in Watts and in L.A. and all that. And so it was a social contract, a construct. Also, we noticed that in our traditional neighborhoods, people were really helping one another. Community organizations were alive, school, parent teachers association, all kinds of groups were spontaneously coming together because people saw one another face to face in the flesh, not looking through the mirror of a car from one windshield to another. And they were able to form human relationships. So neighborhood is also a social and cultural manifestation. So what we've tried to say, and what we tried to do in my time, and it's very important, was to say that neighborhood construct, which traditionally was in the city, is still very relevant for the 21st century. And it is a way for people to avoid the alienation that's there. Now, did we get it all right? No, because what snuck up on us, of all things, was affordability of housing. You know, we were really trying as best we could to make sure that the market could deliver housing, but that 20% of people were being left out. That was the low-income people. They were being left out on the street. And so we put a lot of time and energy to that 20%. And so if you go to all our new neighborhoods, you'll find there's a mix of low-income people and other people. In those days, and we're now talking 25 years ago, 20 years ago, middle-income affordability was not the issue it is today. Either people, and I remember when I was a young fellow, but also a lot of other people, if you were careful and prudent with your money, and as you worked, you and your family, you could save enough money and you could buy into a community, and it would be, ultimately, you might have to have two or three, larger or more spacious or more appropriate housing for yourself, but you could get in. And then a little later, it started that parents started adding to help their children. Right now, as you know, over half of new first-time homeowners, the parents are helping them with the down payments and other things. And so it wasn't as big of a problem as it is today. And our philosophy was, let the market do what it naturally does, and then let's intervene where the market doesn't work. And in those days, the market didn't work for low-income people. Mm-hmm. Now, did we build enough low-income housing? No, because at the same time, the governments of our country made some very bad decisions about mental illness and about drug addiction, which meant we had more people on the street than we ever thought we were going to have. And so we didn't keep up with the low-income housing. And then, of course, the middle-income housing. In about 2010, the middle-income affordability issue just emerged as really an urgent issue. And I say in my book that if we don't solve it, all of the progress we made in my generation will be lost.
It sounds like you anticipated perhaps the fallouts of the legacy of Vancouverism, but were you surprised at all about maybe the negative reviews from the Tyee and the Globe and Mail about Vancouverism?
Well, you know, I never meant this book to be something that everyone says, oh, it's the most fantastic book, thank you very much. I meant this book to set off a conversation about the issues of that time and also the issues of today. I have not had any problems with the reviews that this book has had so far. The critical commentary to me has been useful because I think it brings to the table issues that really need careful attention. the people who actually read my book are going to find that in that book, I put forward solutions. I don't just say, "Oh, we did a fantastic job in in the late 80s to the late 2010." The book is not about that. The book says that, but it also lays out where I think the issues are, where I think the resets need to happen for the future. The other thing is that there's an awfully lot from that time that can be inspirational to people in this time. You know, mm-hmm. we faced a crisis of low-income housing, and our generation rose to that as best we could. This generation faces a crisis of middle-income housing. It can't go back to old solutions. It has to rise to the occasion and create new solutions. I hope that people will see that we worked in our time on a basis of a set of principles, and we applied them the best we could. We tried to look as forward as we could, and of course, that's a very limited foresight. But we did do things very different than had been done in the past and had been done by others around us. We were very innovative. And I hope this book inspires a new generation to be innovative.
I think you mentioned before that a lot of the things that you were doing in the city of Vancouver were in response to globalization, to a changing economy that was moving away from industrialization. Could you perhaps illustrate how it affected, or the lack of industrialization affected city planning?
Well, you know, we lived in a time where the real economy of this city was run by the resource industry. And so, cutting our forests, fishing, and all those things were what we did. And we took that resource and we harvested it and sent it off to the world. And that was fine. When that died, the question is, what do you do as a city? And in the contemporary world, much of the production that used to happen in North American cities is happening elsewhere in the world. So what do you do in a North American city? We said that probably we had a role in all of the ideas industries, whether it was the arts or whether it was technology or whether it was filmmaking. It turns out we're now a huge filmmaking center in North America and the world, that we needed to develop that sector. Well, that sector is a little different than other sectors in terms of how people come to their work. People go to places that they want to be, and their talent and skills and amazing ideas cause the business to go to them. It's not the way it used to be that a company would set up, and if you want to work for them, you come here, wherever that happened to be. No, we now live in a time where smart people, clever people, creative people, they go where they want to go, and then the corporate has to follow them. So we said this city needed to become a place that people wanted to come to and they wanted to live in and be with and raise their families. And we based that on a very simple principle, and that was to increase the moment-to-moment, day-to-day livability of our city, to improve the experience of our city. You know, we had a city that there were a lot of dangerous areas. We had a city that there was high vacancy rates in areas. We had cities where neighborhoods were falling apart. We had a city that was starting to pollute its environment. All of that was happening, and we knew that that's not going to be the kind of city that draws the intelligentsia of the world to come and want to make their home here. And so at one point we said, and it was kind of a joke, that we had to live off our wits and our good looks. And that's what was really driving us, a much more fulfilling experience in living in a city. And that's what we were trying to do.
Right. And I made a note of this, that you were quoting Grace McCarthy, who is a former provincial cabinet minister. And exactly what you said, Vancouver has to live off its wits and good looks. And in order to kind of attract the kind of workforce that you need to have that sort of economy. But at the same time, it seems like Vancouver has become too attractive, because there is a huge demand to live in Vancouver, but that's also driving up prices.
So the question I ask anyone who says that to me, do you want our city to be less attractive? Do you want to have a less quality lifestyle on a moment-to-moment, day-to-day, when you leave that microphone and walk outside? Do you want pollution? Do you want to have to, only the way to get around is to drive your car? Do you not want to have decent housing? Do you not want to have parks and all those things? I don't think the solution to looking after our issues is to go back to a dysfunctional, polluting, and toxic city. I think the solution is to say, as we become more attractive, we have to pay more attention to the needs of our people. Now there's a housing need that we didn't really feel that was there in the past. Well, we have to protect housing for our people, the next, the second generation, the third generation, fifth generation, as they come along and need housing. We have to make sure that housing is there. I think the smartest cities in the world are not diminishing themselves so they get out of these problems. They are actually addressing the problems in new and creative ways. I don't think the answer is to push back, and I don't think the answer is that we should settle back into obscurity as a city in an economy that's becoming increasingly a world-based economy. I think instead we should say, this is a great place to live, and many people are going to want to come here. By the way, this is the same issue being faced by Paris and Rome and Singapore and many cities around the world. And we're going to do what those cities are doing. We're going to protect our housing. We're going to protect the rights of our people. We're going to make sure that these things you hear about money laundering, well, if that's going on, let's deal with it. Let's not just say, let's make our city so toxic that the money launderers will go elsewhere, because that also means our city is toxic for us.
Do you have any suggestions for how we might achieve that?
Well, I in my book, I actually put quite a few suggestions forward. Number one, we need a new strategy for housing our people. The whole strategy of the past where we had non-market for a few, 20%, and market for everyone else, no longer works. The reset that I recommend in this book is we would have a middle sector of secure middle-income housing, home ownership as well as rental housing, so people can build their equity. And then with that, that would give people more options. In terms of the problems of our street, the street difficulties we have and the homeless we have, I recommend in the book that we have a whole new triple government initiative to start to address those issues of supports for mentally ill people and arrangements to help them off the streets and re-education and all the things they need and the supports they need. And that we know, and that we be inspired by an initiative taken back in the 90s called the Vancouver Agreement, where, you know, we were actually seeing addictions as an illness that we could solve, and we were making huge progress. So those are just two. There are, though, other challenges that are out there that are we're going to face as a city that people aren't even thinking about right now. For example, autonomous driving and the new ways to move around. We can either be victimized by that or we can find great opportunity in that. In my book, I suggest a strategy of how we could benefit by that by opening up a lot more public space. There are other things happening around the world that we could benefit from. This issue of affordability faced by our middle-income citizens. Elsewhere in the world, a huge growth in the sharing economy is happening. In where I work in Finland, people are saying that they believe through digital arrangements by and large for sharing, they can cut their living costs by 30%. Well, if you can cut your living costs by 30%, that makes it much more affordable for middle-income people. So we have to be worldly and be aware of these new innovations happening in the world. We have to be courageous, and I believe my generation was courageous, to do things in a different way, to challenge the status quo of the way things were done in the past. And we have to take action which is risky. And right now, I see all too much in this city, as a lot of people complaining about this, complaining about that, but I don't see people recommending the risky action to solve the problem.
So you mentioned a few times that you are working with other cities around the world to resolve their urban planning issues. And I was wondering, how replicable is Vancouverism, or the kind of philosophy that the city of Vancouver has adapted? Because Abu Dhabi has very different environment and very different economy.
What we're finding around the world, and this is a question that was at the top of my consciousness about a decade ago, you see, in principle, I don't think any city should be like any other city I think that we diminish the human culture when that happens. What I've discovered, though, as I've worked, whether it was in the Middle East or Russia or the Nordic countries or Australia or here in North America, that the underlying principles seem to stay relatively dependable, mixing up use and intensifying and active mobility and alternatives to the car, and all those kind of issues are very relevant. The key is to do them in a way that suits the culture and the background and the people. For example, in our work in the Middle East, we tapped into a whole tradition of Islamic urbanism. We just didn't import Vancouverism, but we took the whole tradition of how families like to live in multiple, almost tribal relationships, extended families, and how the housing needed to be clustered, and how the housing clusters needed to be in a walking distance of the mosque, and how women have a different way of engaging with the outside world than in our culture. And we didn't try to criticize all that. We just tried to say, what does that say about these principles? It doesn't mean that mixed use is wrong. It turns out that the societies around the world, almost regardless of their indigenous culture, who are embracing the mix and the intensity, are becoming much more sustainable, much more in line with the environment, because that's a worldwide crisis. But everywhere is different. So if you look at the visions and that we put forward in Abu Dhabi, you will see it's nothing like, absolutely nothing like Vancouver. There is one project in Dubai that everyone says looks like Vancouver, and we had nothing to do with it, and we think it's a bad project. They tried to create something like the tower podium and the water, and it didn't work. It was a bad copy. We didn't do that. But the principles, I'm so surprised. I never go into a part of the world and say, these principles will apply. But I do go in the part of the world and I say, I think these principles are relevant. And I ask the question, do they apply here? And are there other principles that you would add to those? And I think that is the intelligent way that we'll build the cities of the future. We are in a crisis. We always talk about our crisis of the environment, which of course is very real. But we're also in a crisis of cities. We are urbanizing so fast that we're building cities that are very, very brutal. Cities that are not very humane, cities that are not fulfilling for our people. And we need the kind of principles, and we need to share those. But it's just like writing a book. You know the structure of telling a story, but that story is different every time you write a new one. And that's what should happen in cities. The principles are pretty applicable, but they should be applied very differently.
Okay, thank you so much, Larry, for coming in and speaking with us. It was truly a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me, and thank you for having me.
All right. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, if you're just tuning in. We are just wrapping up our show, and the interview you just heard was with Larry Beasley, who just wrote the book Vancouverism, which is actually launching tonight, I think as we speak, downtown. That book is about the way the city of Vancouver has been planned and how Larry recommends it be planned in the future. And it was received with mixed reviews, not necessarily the quality of the book, but his legacy sort of as an urban planner. And while we have a few minutes until the next programmer comes in, Spencer Lawtu, for his show, because I don't see him around, we'll just chat a little bit about that amongst ourselves here at the News Collective. So Christina Song did that interview, which was very well done. Thank you, Christina. I was wondering, could you first just tell our listeners a little bit about the criticisms that were leveled by, say, the Tai? Christopher Chung wrote an article, as well as the Globe and Mail, I believe.
Okay, so I think by the Tai article, mm-hmm. really focused on the fact that the sort of successes that Vancouver has had, it's more about the confluence of factors that were external to city planning itself. It's about the sort of wave of wealth that came into Vancouver,
yeah.
the capital, and the...
Like after Expo.
After
86.
Yeah, after that, and I guess the migration of many people into the city who already had capital that they brought with them. So it was relatively easy to sort of have like an affluent and beautiful city and sort of have the regulations be funded by this, and it could be leveraged. And for the most obvious reason, which is that Vancouver is unaffordable right now for mm-hmm. most people. And I think there was, I guess there was like concerns about the lack of regard in this issue when the developments were happening in Vancouver. I think there was a lot of like NIMBYism that was happening by contractors, by these developers. And these were kind of, I think Larry Beasley was sort of seen as being part of that system where these mm-hmm. developments were happening and neighborhoods were sort of being taken over by people who had more wealth.
Right. Okay, so let me just make sure I understand you. So from the Tai Yi, Christopher Chung wrote a review of this book, and he was saying that, first off, the influx of wealth through immigration and investment, in large part following Expo 86, wasn't necessarily due to the way the city was planned.
Right.
Okay. And then two, that there was part of the design. So the designs you're talking about, like the big condos and stuff, were those developed after Expo 86?
You know, I'm not quite sure if that was mentioned in the article, but I think I don't think that
he it's was, not maybe necessarily.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily because of anything the city had done on its.
Right.
Like, deliberately.
But when we're talking about, I know we just covered this in the interview, but just to reiterate, like, when we're talking about Vancouverism, we're talking about designs that are more dense, so taller buildings. We're talking about more transit, more available transit. We're talking about clear windows on the towers, condo towers, which I thought was interesting, versus dark windows. So you have more transparency and light and lighter buildings, lighter looking buildings, as well as these view cones, which are spaces between buildings so that folks who don't necessarily live in tall, fancy condos can still see the mountains. That's all part of Vancouverism, right? The urban planning strategy leads to those things.
So basically, I think the concern mostly about within Vancouverism is about how consumable living in the city is, how beautiful it is, and how easy it is to access your job, your day-to-day, and how accommodating it is for what you desire within a city, which is like the view.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the whole City of Glass thing was maybe like an integral principle to Vancouverism. I think that was just like maybe a preference of the city planners. I think so, like Larry says, if he like takes it into a city like Abu Dhabi, I'm not sure if he'd say you have to have clear glass, you can't have dark glass.
Yeah. As he said, every city should be designed uniquely.
Right, according to their culture and environment.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So as I was listening to the article, I was also sort of skimming Christopher's article or review of the book in the Tai Yi, and I wanted to just talk a little bit about some of the things that came up. So Larry Beasley said to you that back in the day, which I think he was referring to like the 70s, 80s, though correct me if I'm wrong, the market worked for low-income housing, to produce low-income housing, is what he said. And they had the perspective as city planners that they would let the market do the work and only intervene when it didn't work. And now we're at a place where that's not the case anymore.
Oh, so I think he's saying that it hadn't been working for low-income housing. And I don't think he's claiming that it's working for low-income housing.
No, but, not now, but it did.
No, I think he's saying that back in those days, the main concern was about the lowest 20% of income earners. And right now, the middle income earners also have to be taken account because they can't afford housing here either.
Yeah.
So I think he's saying like maybe I think he said 20 or 25 years ago, it wasn't so much an issue for middle income earners. But now it is. And they also need to be accommodated. And their needs also have to be taken account for. But okay. I kind of find it odd that he thinks that low-income housing was provided for as a city planning perspective. But I think I think what he was saying was that the failure actually came from like a larger governmental, oversight.
Like they needed more funding from different bodies of government, like provincial and federal.
Yeah, I think I think he's saying that low-income housing or low-income people were also not provided for because, I guess he mentions mental illness, their mental health was not kind of provided for.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I kind of like also question whether mental health was the largest or biggest issue.
Right. Fair.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just getting word that the Spencer Law 2 show has a repeat, so we'll wrap this up and then we'll go to that programming. But the last thing I wanted to say is just that the general criticism, at least from the Tai Yee article that we were talking about, seems to be that basically Vancouverism as an urban planning strategy has assisted in making the city more unlivable than livable. Like the tactics that were taken to make it so livable and more sustainable and to enhance its beauty and livability ultimately made it unaffordable to live in for most people.
Right. And I think, although to be fair to Larry Beasley, I think he kind of like he knows that the affordability is a problem. And I think that his vision of like attracting people who have the human capital, like ideas and thinkers and creative people, of attracting those people in order to fuel a different post-industrial economy, it's not going to work if your city's unaffordable and young people aren't able to come into your city and be assured that they're going to have a housing.
Right. So he knows that's a problem, but he doesn't necessarily attribute it to his urban planning.
I think he thinks that there should be an addendum to his urban planning principles.
What do you mean by that?
I think he means that there should be more support. But during the interview, he wasn't quite concrete about what that step should be, but I think the general consensus was like you need to work on affordability.
yeah okay. Cool. Well, we'll leave it off there. Thank you very much, Christina, for your work. So as I mentioned, we're gonna go to the Spencer Law 2 show. It is a repeat today for his fans from April 25th. So sorry for cutting into the beginning of that. We weren't sure if it was happening or not. But you've been listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Tune in again next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more local news. Also, do check out our podcast, Seeking Office. We have a new episode up, one that I was working on over the last like month, kind of here and there. It's called Charlie and Lena, and it's a bit of a break from our usual stuff. It's, as I've described it, experimental news. So it is a love story that takes place in Bloedel Conservatory. It is news because it is the 50th anniversary of Bloedel Conservatory. It opened in 1969. So it's a story about someone who worked there and her relationship with a parrot named Charlie. So check that out. Up next, we have the Spencer Law 2 show. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.